on yet. Not on yet. Okay.
Great to see such a crowd out there, and welcome everyone to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. How many of you are here for your first Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture? Great, that is wonderful. How did you guys hear about us? Meetup, internet?
Meetup.
Okay. Word of mouth. All right, so sounds like Meetup's doing a good job getting the word out. So particularly to you newcomers, just to kind of tell you a little bit about what we're about and our program. We are a fairly unique organization. We've been doing this lecture series for more than 30 years, back before my time, and we're one of those rare organizations that doesn't try to promote a particular viewpoint. I think there's a reason we're called the Forum. Our job is to provide a forum for people from all different kinds of intellectual viewpoints to come and present their views, and for us to be able to absorb them and have an interchange, a Q&A with them. And we are completely volunteer and nonprofit. We have no salaried staff. We have a volunteer board, on which I serve. But we do have expenses, and so we ask that you make a $5 membership, not a member, admission, mission payment, I guess is the best thing to call it. Dr. David Alkeck there will accept your payment on the way out if you didn't get a chance to pay him on the way in. And if you want to become a regular, $35 will get you a 6-month, which is pretty close to half price if you're going to be a wholesale consumer of the service. So we'll have about 45 minutes to an hour of a lecture, and we ask you to kind of hold your questions until after that, and then that'll leave us, you know, about half an hour for a Q&A that we'll moderate and recognize people one at a time. The main social hour is the 6:30 to 7:30 meal beforehand, maybe a little chance to socialize afterwards, but they close the doors here at 9, so you know, we'll need to clear out fairly quick. Of course, you're welcome to take the conversation to other nearby watering holes if you see fit. It's kind of fitting. This was completely unplanned, but we happen to have tonight the coach of the defending champion Dallas Philosophers Forum Jeopardy team here tonight. And so we will actually be having the second Dallas Philosophers Forum Jeopardy event on May 26th at the Unity Church of Dallas Fellowship Hall on Forest Lane, 6525 Forest Lane. So we'll have three schools again competing on questions for the philosophy topic and for cash prizes. And if you'd like to support us in that, we will take donations to help fund the prizes, and they are tax deductible since we're a 501c3 organization. So I think that's all the business of the evening, so we can get on with the main event. We are privileged tonight to have Dr. Ken Williford, who is the chair of the philosophy department at University of Texas at Arlington, as well as being the coach of the defending champion team. And he'll be speaking to us tonight on the topic of meditation, neuroscience, and ethics. And we'll address such questions as, what is meditation? What are the varieties of meditation? What does meditation do to your brain, according to contemporary neuroscience? And what is the relationship between meditation and religious experience? So let's give a warm Dallas Philosophers Forum welcome to Dr. Ken Williford.
Thank you very much.
Am I on here?
You're on.
Thank you very much for that. I've never been really big on college sports, even though I went to like a big Ten university. But Philosopher's Jeopardy is a college sport I can really get behind. And, maybe I'll come, you know, painted up and drunk.
So I started to thank people ahead of time. Thank you all. And thank David Alkeck for making the initial arrangements and contacting me about this. This is my third time to do this, and happy to do it. And my family and students and the department and so on.
That's my mother. My kids call her GABA for grandmother, so she's not a neurotransmitter. My son was asking me the last night, he said, GABA? What are you talking about? Your mom's named after a neurotransmitter? So I should say a couple of things. I don't consider myself an authority on any of these topics, but I'm going to pontificate on them anyway. time-honored philosophical practice. And since this is not a peer-reviewed journal article I'm working on here, it'll be all right. So I like that. I know some things about meditation, neuroscience, ethics compared to religion, Buddhism, but not a ton. Don't purport to be an expert on those. So please be sure you double and triple check any factual claim I make that you might be interested in, and examine, of course, the philosophical claims. Not that there's any danger here that somebody would take me as a guru or authority on something. The synthetic a priori exists or something. So what I put forward today is in no way intended to represent the opinions of anyone at UT Arlington. So you don't sue my home university for some crazy thing I say. You can sue me, but don't sue the university. And I make a lot of jokes, but I don't mean any disrespect. It's just part of my nature. So I do joke about things that I take very seriously. So people find that weird to make fun of things that you take very seriously, but I do that. Habitually. So philosophers tend to be all. So this is the introduction. That's what I'm doing right now. And we'll say, what is meditation? Well, I use this ridiculous term, spiritual technologies. We'll talk about that. And then we'll talk about meditation as one of those technologies. Talk about meditation in the brain, three kinds of meditation, focused attention, mindfulness, and compassion meditation. Then we'll talk a little bit about whether or not meditation enhances your interoceptive capabilities, like can you notice what's going on in your body better. Then we'll talk about meditation in philosophy, what bearing or relation it has to epistemological questions and questions about consciousness, about metaphysics and value, and the conclusion will be a little bit about meditation and ethics. Spiritual technology. I thought that's a really corny term, but I'm going to use it anyway. And I thought, surely I'm not the first person to have thought of this. You know how it is. You Google something and you find, like, they've been there before. Like, it's a good idea, it's a bad idea, it doesn't matter. You can find. Pretty soon it'll be impossible to write anything that hasn't already been written. So it'll be like, oh, it's not. I wasn't plagiarizing. Well, it looks like it. So just because of the sheer quantity of information out there. So I found spiritual technology, the invisible force behind miracles. And the Church of Spiritual Technology Vault. So apparently there's like a vault buried in Nevada that contains, I think it's writings of L. Ron Hubbard, but I can't No, please, nobody, like, don't tell the Church of Scientology that. I don't want to get sued. I'm not sure that that's what that is, but that's what it seemed like when I looked at it. Maybe it was a gimmick or a hoax or something, meant to poke fun at the Church of Scientology. I don't know. But by spiritual technology, I'm going to mean any practice or method whereby one can, at least somewhat reliably, induce a mystical or religious experience in oneself, or cultivate one's ability to interpret one's ordinary experiences in religious or mystical terms, or conform one's practice to a mystical or religious worldview. We might also say, it doesn't have to be religious in the traditional sense. It could be just to cultivate an ethical view or a metaphysical view. It's not necessarily religious. But sort of traditionally, this has been connected to religious experience. All such practices involve the alteration of consciousness or one's cognitive and affective patterns, inclusive or both. So what are some spiritual technologies? Well, there's meditation, which we'll talk about. Prayer, of course. Almost every religion has something analogous to prayer. Fasting, It's probably a very ancient thing in the history of Homo sapiens to figure out that if you go without food, you start to think differently. Does stuff to you. And, okay, might put you in the right frame of mind. It might turn you into something insane. Or it might take all your energy, too. But, you know, eventually they harness this for spiritual purposes. Dancing with or without snakes. This is an actual picture. Snake handling still goes on in the United States. It's illegal, still. It's an interesting question about whether it really should be illegal, given, you know. But occasionally people die from this. And it's an interesting practice from a number of points of view. And I imagine that it does alter your consciousness pretty significantly to hold venomous snakes and dance. Chanting, of course, and singing and listening to music. Almost everybody's familiar with that. And aesthetic productions generally, arts. And this is a Tibetan monks making a sand mandala, which is an extremely time-intensive process. And makes this, as I'm sure a lot of you know, this very beautiful thing, very intricate, with a lot of patterns in it and a lot of symbols in it, which they then, at the end of a initiation or whatever ceremony they're doing, like the Kala Chakra initiation, for example, they wipe it away and dump the sand into a nearby river. They don't, keep them, right? And, of course, that symbolizes impermanence. Yoga and breathing exercises, all heard of this. Sleep deprivation, another one that must be really ancient. Like, go without sleep long enough, you'll start, things are going to change. Stuff's going to happen. Mantras and other forms of repetition. We might also add glossolalia here, speaking in tongues. So you do this stuff, you can learn these mantras and you may or may not know what they mean, but some of them are actually sort of deliberately constructed to not be particularly meaningful. The point is just to repeat them. And it's a similar thing with speaking in tongues. You just start doing it. And I think is just a hypothesis. I don't know. But I think what might happen is that you're tying up your motor area, Broca's area, for producing speech, and that actually stops interferes with the normal production of inner speech, inner thought. So you've tied that, so that way you kind of break free from thought and, distracting thoughts. You've got this thing babbling, right? And that distracts you from the inner speech or interferes with the production of inner speech. That's just a hypothesis, something we should test. Sensory deprivation. Like, you can get in a sensory deprivation tank or otherwise go, cloister yourself in a cave or in a cloister, for that matter. Block off your senses. And sensory overstimulation, on the other hand. Wild, ecstatic dancing, jumping the fire, putting the strobe lights on. These are all different ways you can induce altered states of consciousness that you can try to harness to some kind of spiritual purpose. At least historically, these are the examples one thinks of. And of course, sex. There's nothing more mind-altering than sex. At least, whether it's good or bad, it's mind-altering. It does change the mindset you're in. You may know these carvings on some certain Hindu temples that are part of tantric Hinduism. And I should have put on here some tantric Buddhist iconography. Tantric Buddhist iconography is very sexualized. Often shows copulation between a Buddha, they have many Buddhas actually, not just Siddhartha or Gautama, and a consort, tantric consort. And the idea is that this symbolizes the union of wisdom and compassion. And there are some actual tantric Buddhist rites that still go on in Tibetan Buddhism that involve actual intercourse, though in very special circumstances. Some have said that the Dalai Lama himself has a tantric consort. This is not widely publicized, the buzz. And people kind of go, what? But it's the kind of one exception. If you're a Buddhist practitioner of that particular strain, it's the one exception to the general celibacy, the general prohibition of sex on the part of monks. Entheogenic drugs. And I forget when the word entheogenic was coined. The sort of previous word was psychedelic, which was coined by a psychiatrist, actually, in the 1950s, I believe, Humphrey Osmond in Canada. That's before LSD was illegal, and they were giving it to alcoholics and various schizophrenics, all kinds of people to see what effects it had and if they had any therapeutic value. And so psychedelic meant mind manifesting, literally. Entheogenic means engendering the divine within. And it refers to the practice, for example, of taking peyote and peyote ceremonies. This is a picture of a Native American church peyote ceremony going on. But you probably know that drugs have been taken in plants, right? Plant-derived drugs have been taken for centuries on the part of many, many cultures for religious purposes. This is nothing. This shouldn't be news to anybody. Visualization practices. It's another way to alter your consciousness. And then, of course, you can combine all these things. You're speaking in tongues or chanting a mantra while you're taking LSD, gobbling LSD, and practicing some yoga, and then you have great sex. I mean, all to get closer to change your... I hope nobody's freaking out here. I'm not advocating anything. I'm just saying that people do this kind of stuff. So, four things. Similar practices can be carried out in quite different contexts. So there's prayer in almost every religion. You find prayer. But the doctrinal context, the background beliefs, there can be totally different. You can be praying to the one God, or you can be praying to many gods, or you can... So different religions, but they still have this kind of practice. And of course, and it's true that meditation of one form or another is practiced in a number of religious traditions, not just Buddhism and Hinduism. Usually there's a framework of beliefs about the world or about human nature or values in terms of which the practitioners interpret and evaluate these practices and their outcomes. So to take one example, you may know that certain Catholic mystics, like Teresa of Avila, is that right?
Avila.
And Hildegard von Bingen is another one that comes to mind. They had religious visions. They practiced forms of contemplation. And they had to get their religious visions approved by the authorities. So they had to kind of be interviewed, and the archbishops and so on had to make sure that, this wasn't the devil doing that. Now, how do we know that it's not the devil doing this? Well, we look at, ye shall know them by their fruits. We look to see, does it make the person more devout? Does it make the person a more moral and, wholesome and good person? Is it misleading anybody? Are they using this as a way to say, hey, look, God's talking to me, don't listen to the Pope anymore, right?
It should happen sometimes.
So as long as they're vetted, then the idea is, okay, yeah, you got the stamp of approval, right? Well, all of that framework of evaluation comes from these beliefs that are, codified in the religion. To various extents, the practices can be carried out in the absence of such doctrinal frameworks. And I say to various extents because some practices, like, for example, making Tibetan Buddhist sand mandalas, make absolutely no sense apart from the doctrinal framework that sort of explains what they're doing and what the mandala means. Otherwise, it's just pretty sand painting. Like, well, that's really nice, right? But to a certain extent, certain practices can be carried out in the absence of doctrinal frameworks. So You could handle snakes and speak in tongues without being a charismatic or without believing any of that. And you could take peyote, whether or not you believe in the doctrines of the Native American church. And of course, you can meditate without being a Buddhist or Hindu or any committed to any particular religion. With or without the frameworks, long-term practice is likely to modify the practitioner's brain in various ways. We'll talk about why this is kind of trivial, in fact. So the term meditation has a variety of meanings, things we could mean by it, but let's like skip the long discussion about what we might mean and get at the heart of my use of it here in this way. So I'm going to say meditation involves, in one way or another, the deliberate and sustained alteration of one's patterns of attention for the purposes of modulating one's behavior or cognitive or affective patterns or augmenting one's knowledge of some domain. Alteration of your patterns of attention, for example, your attention to sensory stimuli, to introspective data, to the stream of thought, to affective and evaluative reactions, just for example. But generally, it's a matter of, in a sustained and deliberate way, changing your patterns of attention, and you typically have some purpose in doing this. You want to change the way you respond to certain things, you want to change the way you feel or think about certain things, or you might think, I want to learn something, and I'm going to actually use meditation as a tool to learn something about myself, for example, or about the way my consciousness unfolds over time. Or if you're more ambitious, you might think, you're going to learn something about the very nature of reality, or ultimate reality, by meditating. We'll come back to that kind of more ambitious claim in a bit. So here's the thing. On that definition I just gave, many things seem to fit it that we wouldn't normally call meditation. So, for example, you're learning how to play a piece of music. Well, you have to focus, you have to pay attention in a sustained and deliberate way, and you have a goal. Your goal is to be able to play the thing fluidly. Or learning how to balance on a balancing beam. If you're a gymnast, like my daughter, you have to pay attention, focus on things, and it's going to change your behavior and your responses. So what, should we call that meditation too? So we got three options here. We can start calling all these other things forms of meditation, which seems kind of very, very inclusive and maybe kind of spreads out the definition so much that we kind of go, oh, you practice meditation? Yes. Well, what do? I play the guitar. Right. I work on my lawn. Or we could find other and hopefully non-arbitrary conditions that further restrict the space. So things that narrow our definition down, but you'll find if you look, for example, there's an article I'm going to be talking about, the way they do it is they just take things that have traditionally been called meditation in Buddhism and say, well, we're talking about those. But then they make analogies with things like learning how to play music and so on. Or, and this is what they do, they rely on the history and sociology of the term, like what things have in fact been called meditation. It's kind of it's what some people think of as a sociologically nominalist approach to things. So you sometimes encounter this in questions about what philosophy is. Somebody, there'll be endless debates among philosophers about what philosophy is. And then somebody will go, well, why don't we just say philosophy is whatever has been called philosophy? That's disappointing. So you could do that. What I'll do, though, here, so I think that, arguably, what is really essential to meditation as a technique is what it has in common with the sustained attentional modification efforts we find in sport, music, musical practice, in-depth study, etc., and not the particular objects of focus or the particular soteriological goals of the practice, soteriology, meaning aiming at some kind of salvation or liberation or some kind of religious or psychological transformation. I'm actually happy with option one, in a way.
So, but I will actually focus on types of meditation important in the Buddhist tradition, which means we'll talk about some stuff that has historically been closely associated with meditation.
Right.
So I'm actually trying to say that what you do when you meditate is so similar to what you do when you focus your attention on any mastering any kind of practice that that's really what's essential to it. And you're just changing the goal. But the method or the practice is essentially the same. Close enough. And this is borne out by what this article I'm going to talk about. So we'll specify a bit further and talk about three types of meditation historically that have a certain historical lineage in the Buddhist tradition. And they have there's some similarity to other traditions too. Focused attention or one-pointed meditation, shamatha Shamatha bhavana. I can't really pronounce Pali or Sanskrit. So. But this means basically tranquility. It also can mean concentration. And bhavana means meditation or cultivation, development. Really what that word means, the word for meditation in Pali. So in one-pointed or focused attention meditation, that's one of the most common kinds. Like if you've ever practiced meditation at a yoga studio, or you focus on your breath, take deep breath, keep focusing on your breath. Whenever your attention wanders, which it will do, it'll be like, oh, but what about blah, 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 blah. Right? And then you go, back to my breath. But you have to pick up the kids in 10 minutes. Back to my breath. Still have 5 minutes. That's one-pointed meditation. You can also do it where you focus on a single object, like put a candle in front of you and stare at the candle and focus on the candle. But the idea is to keep bringing your attention back to an object that you've picked out. The breath is really nice because everybody has to breathe. So if you can breathe, doesn't matter what else your situation is, if you've got your breath, you can focus on it. If you're alive, you can focus on your breath. And then mindfulness, also called open monitoring meditation, or satipatthana. This actually means, sati means mindfulness, basically, or awareness. And patthana means foundations of, so this is foundations of mindfulness. It traditionally includes mindfulness or observation of your body, and then the sensations of your body, and then your mind itself, and then the contents of your mind. So there's a kind of a distinction between the mind and its contents. The contents always change, but certain features of the mind remain constant. And open monitoring means you're just letting things flow. You're not focusing your attention on anything in particular, but you're not blocking anything out, and you're not latching on to anything. So if thoughts come like, oh my gosh, I need to send that stuff to the dean or whatever, right? You just kind of go, uh-huh, let it go. If you start to get a pain somewhere, like, ah, you just let it go. Even if it keeps hurting, let it go. Just let everything go. And just be open to everything that comes. Kind of let yourself be open to it. And don't judge or conceptualize or latch on to anything. Just let it flow. Right? You're reminded of something that somebody said that makes you mad and insults you. Just let it go. It's okay. Let it go. And then compassion meditation, or metta bhavana. This is a practice that is very emphasized in Tibetan Buddhism, actually. And here you do things like visualize that other people, take people that you really don't like, visualize and try to react to them as if they were your mother. Now, if you had a bad relationship with your mother, pick somebody else. Pick somebody that you like. Pick a child that you love, or pick, your father, or a good friend, or somebody you love. Now, if you hate everyone, I don't know what to do. I guess you pick yourself, right? Oh, if you hate yourself, you're then I give up. But you And imagine that every person you encounter is like your mother. And extend it even to all sentient beings, all living beings. This is the kind of universal ethic, or, you know, kind of what they call the bodhisattva ethic. Extend it to all. So, and the idea, there's actually a metaphysical justification behind this. Of course, you don't need to believe any of that to benefit from it, but the metaphysical justification is something like, well, you've already been incarnated infinitely many times. You've been everything, actually. And you've borne every relationship to every other person already. So, in fact, all beings have already been your mother. Yes, but they've also been my murderer, right? They've also, you know, tortured me. Well, forget about that, right? Because we want to, going forward, we want things to go well, so we'll emphasize the good stuff. That's the idea. But you practice various techniques for getting yourself to react to people with loving kindness and compassion, and not with aversion, suspicion, paranoia, hatred, and so on.
Fear,
disdain, so on. So, what is meditation defined in this way, in these three specific types? What does it do to your brain? This is your brain on meditation, kids. So, there is an article, what a coincidence, actually. It's in the November 2014 edition of Scientific American. Nice little summary. Of course, it's a Scientific American one. It doesn't have the details that you might want. But it's a nice summary. This is Antoine Lutz. He's a French neuroscientist who's been working on contemplative neuroscience, they call it, for many years now. I believe he was a student of Francisco Varela, but I can't remember for sure. That's Matthew Ricard, who was a student of François Jacob, the great French cell biologist. But he abandoned cell biology and became a Buddhist monk about 40 years ago. He's been living in Nepal, but he has been a major player in the field of contemplative neuroscience, and that's Richard Davidson at University of Wisconsin Madison, where there's a whole lab devoted to studying what meditation does to your brain and its potential therapeutic use. So, what do they say about focused attention meditation? Well, this is the diagram from the article. They isolate a certain kind of cycle that you go in when you do this kind of meditation, which is pretty much exactly what you'd expect, but here they're giving you this sort of neurological details. When you are sort of normally at rest and not doing anything, your mind tends to wander quite a bit. You go from one thing to another. Often you're thinking sort of introspective thoughts, and you're thinking, you know, thoughts that are related to you in some way or other, like, why did I do that? Or I could have done that. Oh, I'm going to have to do that. Oh, yeah, what about that? Oh, I forgot about that. All right, this kind of stuff. And when you do that, there's a network of areas in your brain that kind of go in a cycle. It's called the default mode network. It was discovered about 10 years ago because normally they were putting people in the fMRI and giving them tasks and seeing what their brain does when they do those tasks, because we want to see what areas, you know, are involved in various tasks. Well, then somebody got the bright idea of just looking at people when they weren't doing the task. And it turns out that you have this kind of network but the thought is, it's not really noise. It has a certain kind of associated type of thought process that goes with it when you're just relaxed and not engaged in a task. And then when you get engaged in a task, yeah, it minimizes, gets reduced, and the task-specific areas are increased, their activities increased. So that's going on. Then it's like, okay, I am going to start to focus on my breath, and then what happens is you'll get some distractor that comes, like, oh, what about, right? And then you notice the distractor, and your so-called salience area gets involved. The salience area, think of when you're driving, like I'm driving over here from Arlington, it takes about an hour. Actually, it took about 45 minutes to do. Suddenly, somebody's putting their brakes on.
You don't know why, because you can't see in front of them. You're just driving along, listening to music, blah, 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 blah. When those brake lights, when you see those brake lights, oh, this is correlated with your salience area going, but that's salient, that's important, right? Unlike the red light going off way down the street. The brake lights in front of you, that's important, right? So this is your salience area. So you have a distractor, your salience area goes off, and you realize, okay, we need to get back, we need to move back to what we were doing, focusing on our breath. This happens here, and then sustaining it involves this area as well, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So veteran meditators showed more activity in attention-related brain regions compared with novices. Paradoxically, the most experienced meditators demonstrated less activation than the ones without as much experience. Advanced meditators appear to acquire a level of skill that enables them to acquire a focused state of mind with less effort. These effects resemble the skill of expert musicians and athletes. Another result suggested that the meditators had an enhanced capacity to remain vigilant. So there were two claims here, three actually. One is that attention-related areas are more active. Well, big surprise. You're focusing your attention repeatedly on your breath. That shouldn't surprise anyone. The most experienced meditators demonstrated less activation than the ones without as much experience. Well, what this means is, once you've mastered a skill, it requires less for you to do it. It's just like when you learn a piece of music, after you've got it mastered, it kind of requires less effort and less, and therefore less sort of resources to do it. So you can do it efficiently without all the effort that was required to learn it, and then when you're kind of in an intermediate state before you reach expertise, it requires, you know, more effort, make sure it doesn't go wrong, and once you're a master at it, oh, no problem. Just do it. And then the idea that you have an enhanced capacity to remain vigilant, well, they did an experiment where people have to hear a beep, against background noise over like 10 minutes. And meditators who practice this could pick it out better than people who didn't have any practice with that, because their minds are wandering all over the place, so they don't notice the beep. But you're told, like, listen for the beep. Okay. You're a practice meditator, you're going to get it. None of that, I think, is particularly surprising. What about open monitoring or mindfulness meditation? Open monitoring meditators are capable, quote, capable of optimizing attention so as to minimize the attentional blink. Do you know what the attentional blink is? When you do certain kinds of actually artificially constructed tasks in a psychology laboratory, so you're going to see a bunch of letters flashing, and there's going to be a couple of numbers in there, and you want to see if you can see what numbers they are, see if you can notice when the numbers go, right? If they flash a number, and then flash another number very shortly after it, you typically won't see the other number. It's because it's like, oh, there's a number. And that act of like focusing your attention on that first number you saw distracts you from catching that the one that's right after it. That's called the attentional blink. It's as if your resources were grabbed by that first number, so you don't see the one that's directly after it. Well, if you do it a little bit later, people go, oh, they notice the second one. So there's like something grabbing your attention takes resources that you can't just deploy automatically a few milliseconds, a few hundred milliseconds later. But for open mindfulness, it's like, oh, number, fan, music, background, number. Like, so the attentional blink effect is lowered for open monitoring meditators, the claim. Again, that's not too surprising, because the very goal of the practice is not to let your attention or anything be too gripped by what you observe. About pain, okay, we found that intensity of pain was not reduced in meditators, but it bothered them less than it did members of a control group. So basically, they have some painful stimulus. The intensity, if you ask them how much, you know, where would you rank the pain? Oh, it's a 10.
Where, you know, the control group people are, you know, stop, and the open, I'm exaggerating a bit, I'm sure, but the open monitoring that it is like, yeah, that's definitely a 10. Let me go. Just going to ride it on out. Now, it's a little bit, it reminds one a little bit of the way in which opiate painkillers work. This is a hypothesis someone could check out, but the phenomenology of opiate analgesia is something like, yes, I experience the pain. The pain is not gone. I can notice the pain, but I really don't care about it at all. I remember when my wife was giving birth to our second child, they gave her fentanyl, I believe it is, which is a, you know, an opiate-derived painkiller. And I said, does it still hurt? Yeah.
Does the labor still hurt?
Yeah. That's okay. Right. So one, that's a hypothesis. It'd be an interesting thing to investigate. What is the sort of the profile of your brain and the activated regions when you're under opiate analgesia versus mindfulness meditation? Other tests in our lab have shown that meditation training increases one's ability to better control and buffer basic physiological responses, inflammation or levels of stress hormone, to a socially stressful task. So it's like you're about to do something stressful, you go into the kind of meditative mode, and it reduces stress hormones and so on, and apparently inflammation. Which, again, might not be that surprising. Sort of like, I have a technique for just calming down and kind of reducing the stress hormones. Teasdale and Siegel, there are a couple of researchers in this area, showed in 2000 that for patients who had previously suffered at least 3 episodes of depression, 6 months of mindfulness practice along with cognitive therapy reduced the risk of relapse by 40% in the year following the onset of severe depression. More recently, Siegel demonstrated that the intervention is superior to placebo and has protective effects against relapse comparable to standard maintenance antidepressant therapy. It's a pretty big claim. It's basically saying, you know, did they mention, cognitive therapy. You know, cognitive behavioral therapy is pretty popular these days. And the claim, and often people are given antidepressants and told to do cognitive behavioral therapy together. And the claim here is that you don't need the antidepressants. Just get them to do mindfulness meditation and the cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's just as good. That's a pretty old claim. Lazar and colleagues in 2010 showed that mindfulness training decreased the volume of the amygdala, a region involved in fear processing, for those participants who showed the most notable reductions in stress over the course of the training. So that's interesting. It means that you're kind of finding a way to reduce the fear response, and this has the physiological effect of reducing the volume of your amygdala, which is crucially, though not exclusively, related in fear processing and the fear response. Interesting. Again, though, I might say, this is kind of maybe surprising. This is not that surprising. The one about inflammation, inflammation, yes, but stress hormone. But there's probably this connection between the stress hormone and inflammation. So this is pretty bold claim here. And that's interesting, but maybe not that surprising. What about compassion meditation? So, then we'll get to the good stuff. Promise. We're almost done with the hard stuff. So preliminary results from Singer and Klimeki showed that after a week of meditation-based loving kindness and compassion, novice subjects watched video clips showing suffering people with more positive and benevolent feelings. The other subjects, who just cultivated empathy, experienced emotions that resonated deeply with others' sufferings, but these emotions also brought about negative feelings and thoughts, and this group experienced more distress, sometimes to the point of not being able to control their emotions. So they have this distinction here between compassion and meditation. Compassion, the idea is you want to cultivate a kind of somewhat detached, benevolent attitude toward the suffering of others. Empathy is a matter of sort of actively imagining yourself in the other's position, imagining suffering like they're suffering. Compassion, it's more, as you might expect from the Buddhist tradition, more kind of like objective benevolence, where you're not going to let the suffering of someone else cause you to suffer. So the idea is, if you just try to be more empathic, you're actually going to suffer along with the people you're watching suffer. It's going to actually cause you to suffer in a certain way. Whereas if you cultivate compassion, you'll be able to help them better. So they give an example of a mother whose child is suffering in the hospital. And they say, isn't it better if the mother just stays with the child, holds the child's hand, remains calm, tells him, you know, it's going to be okay, stays with them throughout the child's ordeal, versus the mother who's so torn up by it and so empathic that she herself begins to suffer and can't be in the room with the child. That's kind of the distinction they're making there. And they're claiming that their results back that up. So here are a few other claims. We found that long-term Buddhist practitioners were able, at will, to sustain a particular EEG pattern, specifically high amplitude gamma band oscillations and phase synchrony at between 25 and 42 hertz. Now, they don't really know what that does. There are some hypotheses, but we don't want to go into that. Meditation brings about changes, also in the volume of certain brain areas, possibly reflecting alterations in the number of connections among brain cells. Sarah Lazar and colleagues showed that among longtime meditators, the volume of the brain's gray matter differed in the insula and prefrontal cortices, which are frequently activated during various forms of meditation. Right? Meditation may help diminish inflammation. We saw that, and it may slow... This is the one that seems to be the least believable. But then, who knows? Meditation may slow processes of cellular aging among some practitioners. They're making this claim, like that they have scientific evidence for that. Okay. Well, look, we can be surprised by that one, right, about cellular aging, I think. But should we be surprised about a lot of these other findings? So it's not surprising at all that the practice of these forms of meditation would change the brain in some way, because everything we do changes the brain in some way, and the more we practice, the greater the change. I mean, if you learn how to play the violin, the areas involved in you playing the violin will have a bigger volume, right? Have certain connections they wouldn't have otherwise, and so on. It's also not surprising that they can modulate behavior, attentional capacities, and affective responses. After all, it's a matter of practicing, and we already knew about neuroplasticity. So it's not like it's all that surprising. It's also, I think, not surprising that you can modulate reactions to stressors or reduce stress or anxiety. You start breathing. After all, it's partly a relaxation practice. You get something called the relaxation response. So you do that. It tends to mitigate your stressors. That's not surprising at all. But can it enhance your self-knowledge? For example, can it enhance your sensitivity to your own bodily sensations? Maybe not. Now, here's a study by some friends of mine at the University of Iowa. Not anymore, but they used to be at the University of Iowa. Along with Davidson and Lutz. So Khalsa led the study, and Rudolf and Trinell. Contrary to our prediction, we found no evidence that meditators were superior to non-meditators in the heartbeat detection task, which I'll describe in a second, across several sessions and respiratory modulation conditions. Compared to non-meditators, however, meditators consistently rated their interoceptive performance as superior and the difficulty of the task as easier. These results provide evidence against the notion that practicing attention to internal body sensations enhances the ability to sense the heartbeat at rest. Okay. So they're trying to test, like, does it enhance your interoceptive awareness? One of the practices of mindfulness involves sort of, again, you're not focusing your attention, but you're kind of shifting the attentional field in that direction a bit. Right? And the thought would be, oh, people who do this will get better at noticing various types of bodily sensations. Well, one of the best kind of worked out psychophysical measures for interoception involves the heartbeat detection task. So basically, you're going to hear like a tone
And you want to see if it's simultaneous with your heartbeat or not. And you're just saying, oh yeah, like you're focused on your heartbeat, and you hear like, bit, 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 or, and they modulate that tone, and you got to say, yeah, it happened when it coincided with my heartbeat or not. Well, it turns out that meditators think they're good at this. But they're no better than non-meditators. And non-meditators think they're bad at it. And they are pretty bad at it. So they're not any better at it. Meditators are not any better at it, but they think they are. Which is, might make you think they're suffering from some kind of meditative illusion. I hasten to add, though, that they just test your ability to get your heartbeat at rest. I mean, it's not every kind of bodily sensation, so the jury's still out on others, but still, they do make this mistake. So, could meditation make us think we're better at something than we really are? We should probably be wary of any general claim that meditation can give us enhanced sensory or cognitive abilities, much less what is called in the Hindu and Buddhist tradition, siddhis. These are magic, like, supernatural powers that you supposedly get from meditation. This is Tilopa, a mahasiddha, a great siddha, a person who's achieved this kind of, these abilities. And Tilopa is in the one of the four main lineages of Tibetan Buddhism. And if you know this story of Naropa, his disciple, Tilopa has the ability to manifest himself as, like, withered, peasants and all kinds of stuff. And other powers like clairvoyance, levitation, bilocation, like appearing at two places at once, becoming as small as an atom, it's one of my favorites, materialization, having access to memories from past lives, and so on. Like, all these kind of claims or supernormal powers that you can get from meditation. Of course, that's really hard to believe, right, for someone like me, anyway. But you might think that, that's that's kind of hard to believe and crazy, and any religion that involves that is, crazy. But Buddhism's attitude toward this, at least most Buddhists, sort of the official line on this, is interesting. They say, yes, 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 you can develop all these powers, but who cares? Because they're not going to liberate you from suffering anyway. So it's sort of like, yeah, give us your psychics. Give us whatever you want. Yeah, right. You can manifest beings from your mouth or whatever. I don't care. Who cares? It's not going to end suffering. Focus on the real thing. That's kind of their attitude toward it, which I find interesting. Well, what about Tummo Yoga? Has anyone ever heard of Tummo Yoga? This is an ancient picture of kind of describing Tummo Yoga. And here's somebody purporting to practice it on a snow patch. And the claim is that you can raise your body temperature by a certain type of visualization. And it turns out, in a pretty new paper, that it looks like you can do this by a kind of biofeedback mechanism, plus a certain type of breathing exercise, which is kind of interesting. But you can't raise it that much. You can raise it a bit. And they point out that the story about Tibetan monks in the Himalayas making water steam off of their robes, like they put wet robes on them and they dry the robe. They point out that that would happen anyway. Just that legend and reality part. Just because of the temperature difference, that's going to happen anyhow. And this is an interesting case, Natalia Avsyenka. You ever heard of her? She swims, skinny dips, she's skinny dipping right there, with beluga whales in in the Arctic Ocean. And was able to do that. They wanted to see if beluga whales like to swim with naked people instead of people in wetsuits. Like, were the wetsuits freaking them out? And it turns out that, yeah, they like to swim with her better than, like, with Russian marine biologist dudes in wetsuits. So, now, how does she do? She stayed in this water for 12 minutes. And the story is that about eight minutes is enough to kill most people.
and the water this frigid. Like, they cut holes in the ice. Well, she practices a certain type of yoga and a certain kinds of meditation. She claims that's what enabled her to do it. Who knows? Interesting. So what about the philosophical stuff? So is like any of this of any use, say, for understanding consciousness? And I think, yeah, it might give us some, help you to get a good grasp on certain structures and capacities of consciousness. Like, you might have thought, like, oh, I could never be that relaxed. But yes, you can. Or you might have thought, you know, that you could never get some kind of detachment from the contents of your consciousness. But, oh, yes, you can, right? And that's kind of interesting. So it might help you for what's sometimes called neurophenomenology. And neurophenomenology might be useful in the construction of a good theory of consciousness. But does it open the reducing valve, man? To speak with Aldous Huxley? You may remember that the title of Huxley's famous book, from which the Doors got their name, The Doors of Perception, came from this little saying of William Blake's, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. And it turns out that in the study, the contemporary study of psychedelics, there is still the view that what is happening is that information that normally doesn't make it to the cortex because it's kind of blocked or channeled by the thalamus, it makes it because the thalamus is kind of, you kind of throw a monkey wrench into the thalamus. Then all kinds of stuff gets up there. Your cortex makes the best sense of it can, and so you get all these weird results. And so that hypothesis that, you know, the doors of perception, like you're normally, you have a filter on everything, and you're letting that filter go, so stuff's going to come rushing in that doesn't normally come in. There's some, apparently some validity to that notion. But the idea that that shows us how things really are, that's a bit of a stretch, right? Because really, do you think that things are really that bonkers? Like, you know, just go watch Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Even if you've never read the book, just like watch it. Like, you know,
oh, lizard people.
Like, are the psychedelics like showing you that, yes, you are actually surrounded by lizard people. They just look like regular people most of the time. I mean, right? Okay, there's a more nuanced version of that that the psychedelic epistemologist could maybe develop, but still, right? That might not be plausible either, but anyway. So similarly, sometimes people say, well, mindfulness meditation does that too. Just helps you just to see things as they are. So you could say, well, yes, to the extent that you're blocking out judgments and preoccupations that you normally make automatically, that, you know, are tied to your fears and your hopes and your, yeah, you could see how it could help you get a little more objective picture of things, right? In that sense, yeah. But not like, it's all just a rush of sense data, man. So meditation, what about meditation and mystical or religious knowledge? So here's what I want to say about this. Perhaps we can actually get some kind of knowledge from mystical or meditative contemplation, but it's not something we couldn't figure out by some other means. I'll say what I mean here in a second. And other claims about like God or karma or your past lives or the Buddha nature and so on. Yeah, I mean, come on. Right? Like every proponent of a religious tradition will claim that in some experience they had, they saw that it was true. And that goes from like Mormons knocking on your door telling you to read the Book of Mormon and get a fuzzy feeling, which they will say. I don't say fuzzy, but you know, get the burning in the bosom, I think, was Joseph Smith's way of putting it. From that to, you know, Buddhists, Christians, everybody wants to claim a direct experience for it. So since they're all claiming that, it's all basically epistemically on a par, we have to kind of go, wait, maybe there's a better explanation, rather than that God is just talking to you and the devil is talking to all them other people. Right? That's part of it. So, one type of meditation we didn't talk about, but I'll just mention briefly, Vipassana meditation. This is where you try to cultivate insight into certain things. And in the Buddhist tradition, it often involves philosophizing, actually, and thinking conceptually about certain issues. But I want to suggest that you can get certain things from meditation,
that you can figure out some other way. So it's not like you need meditation to do it, but it is in good resonance with things we know in other ways. Like, things are weird. Whatever that means. But yeah, it is kind of weird, right, that you're here and you exist and all that, right? That some, at some level, your access to your existence, to being, is non-conceptual. Like, you have a direct awareness of your existence that doesn't just involve thinking thoughts about it. It's not like you're just, like, could you just think something and that would go, oh, that's how I know I exist. No, no, no. Remember, Descartes' cogito is kind of badly interpreted as just an argument. It's really about, you have this direct awareness of your own being, your own existence. It's an experience. And you haven't, it's non-conceptual. It's not like you just thought it up. It's not like thinking of a plant or a lectern or something. It's just, but there you are. Everything's connected. Yeah, we know that everything's connected in all kinds of ways. There's nothing like super mysterious about that, right? Economies and ecosystems and planets and stars and gravity. We knew that since Newton, right? Consciousness is empty, and yet the revealer of all content. So, like, it has this kind of continuity, and it's not really, it's not like I'm always looking at a lamp, right? Like, this is not a necessary content of it. Look, see? It's gone away. Right? So it has this kind of emptiness to it. It is a real thing, though. And it's self-aware. This is actually was debated in the Buddhist tradition, because some Buddhists want to say, well, wait a minute, that starts to sound too much like a self, but you can say that without that. And here's my favorite one. You only play the roles you do contingently. Like, just think about it. You did not really pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. You just found yourself in the world with a certain background, with certain parents, at a certain time, at a certain place. You may wonder why you were not born the Sultan of Brunei, right? But you weren't, but he was, right? Why him, right? It's like, because he was awesome, right? So, and you weren't, but I was nothing. Too bad. You know, that's ridiculous, right? You just contingently have these roles that we got to play, and you can get some kind of distance from them by thinking about that and just feeling yourself to just be an existing being versus, oh, I've got to do this and that and that and that. That's basically what I say right there. All right. I basically say the same stuff there. We'll skip that. Conclusion. Well, we're out of time, basically. I have to stop. I have 3 minutes. Meditation and ethics. All right. I was at a conference once where there was a round table on Buddhism and meditation, and I asked, you know, it was about like how mindfulness helps you be, you know, mindfulness meditation and various forms of meditation help you to be a nice person. And I asked about this, you know, well, can't you combine meditation and unethical behavior? And my answer was, yeah, of course you can. Of course, you might want to wonder what is ethical and not ethical here, but here's an example. I mentioned Zen at War. It's a book written by Brian Victoria, who is a Soto Zen Roshi. He knows wherever he speaks. And Zen at War and Zen War Stories are about how the Japanese Zen Buddhist community was almost, not 100%, but like 90%, 95% behind the Japanese war effort and the Japanese domination of Asia prior to World War II. Up to and including training soldiers and so on. And we might also mention, the argument's more indirect, but this book, Sinhalese Buddhist Nationalist Ideology, which is about the situation, really the contemporary situation in Sri Lanka, where you have a Buddhist nationalist government that is often engaged in denying the human rights of ethnic minorities, and maybe not even minorities, maybe almost 50% of the population in Sri Lanka, and also discriminating against people of other faiths. Now, of course, you might say, well, what's the connection with meditation? Of course, yeah, that's indirect, but meditation is a very important part of Theravada Buddhism, which dominates Sri Lanka. And of course, Zen, but you may also know that the samurais, the religion of the samurais was Zen Buddhism too, right? Just read Musashi's book. Musashi was a famous Japanese swordsman in the 17th century, killing something like 60 duels, and so on. Talks about Buddhism at the end of his book, Book of Five Rings. So then you can argue about like the history of Japan. I mean, Japan has a particularly militarist, history. I mean, internally and externally. So you can think, wonder about how it happened. But it did happen that meditation in the form of Zen Buddhism was used to support the training of soldiers for the Japanese war effort and to justify Japanese occupation of various countries in Asia. Another way you might, another thing to consider, which is not so dark, is this kind of antinomianism that you find in a certain branch of Tibetan Buddhism. Is exemplified by Chögyam Trungpa. You heard of Chögyam Trungpa? He started he's a great story. Watch this movie, Crazy Wisdom. He's known as the bad boy of Buddhism. So he did things that by some Buddhist standards would be considered way over the top, sexually and drugs and alcohol, and he was an alcoholic basically, but still this great Buddhist teacher. So does meditation provide you with ethical values? I don't think so. But it seems that it can help you deepen your understanding of the values you have adopted, maybe solidify your practice. So I think generally the techniques are value neutral. You could use them to enhance compassion and altruism, or to enhance hatred and narcissism or indifference. Although, if you think about it, there may be this kind of contingent connection between reducing anxiety, opening the mind, behaving in a less self-centered way, a way that in which you're less attached to the particular roles you find yourself in, and meditative practice. Because if you really think, listen, I'm going to meditate to be like a complete jerk. they don't go together very well. On the other hand, there's a more subtle form of self-righteousness and kind of egoism that can emerge out of meditative practice, like, I'm getting awesome. I actually am. I meditate. Yeah, I meditate. Yeah, I do yoga. That's kind of like, So it's a little more subtle, but it could still, work in that way. So it doesn't tell us what characteristics and attitudes we should value, but it may help us cultivate those we do. Here's Matthew Ricard's statement on ethics. It's basically just a statement of utilitarianism. He didn't get it from meditation, but yeah, it was utilitarianism. So, summary, no surprise that long-term meditative practice changes the brain. No surprise that meditation can modulate emotional reactions, cognition, and mood, and more generally that it alters consciousness. It may or may not enhance your self-knowledge in various dimensions. It's far from clear that it provides access to ultimate reality in a non-trivial sense, like stuff we couldn't know in some other way. As a technique, it's not necessarily tied to any particular religious or ethical or metaphysical outlook. It can, in principle, be combined with any sort of behavior, ethical or not, though there may be a contingent connection between meditation and more ethics-friendly mental states. It doesn't provide us with values, but it can deepen your understanding and solidify one's implementation of the values one does adopt if you meditate on them. Two questions, and this is it. What accounts for the vogue of meditation in the West? It's been going on for a while, and I think the vogue of meditation, if you look, it kind of started in the late 50s and the 1960s, and then got kind of connected up with the social movements in the 60s. I think the motive then was different from what it is now, but there is a stream that goes from then to now. But in the 60s, it was really, people were actually willing to try to make alternative lifestyles. I know they failed miserably, or not totally, but, right. Most people ended up going, in the 80s, they're like, look, LSD's not working, let's do some coke and we'll get jobs. to simplify the transition from the 60s to the 80s. Just watch Forrest Gump. It's in Forrest Gump, that exact thing. Right. So what is the vogue of it now? I start to get afraid that it's really, people are totally stressed out by our economic and social and environmental situations, and we kind of need things to help us endure this. So it doesn't really compare with, say, conditions under which Buddhist monks were practicing this 1,000 years ago or more. Right? It's not. It's a different sort of situation. And people are drawn to it because it gives us a kind of an opiate. And there's actually a book that argues exactly this, Craig Martin's Capitalizing Religion. Apart from the vapid relativism expressed in this book, it's pretty good. I must say, it's fine, sure. Oh, we can't make any truth claims, and I'm not claiming anything. And then, okay, now I'm going to claim some stuff. So. But if we brush that aside, which I guess he feels like he has to say, because, you know, everybody in his particular field has to say, I don't think we know anything, but okay, now I'm going to say some stuff. Apart from that, it's actually pretty interesting. He analyzes one book, the title I forget at the moment, but it's basically saying, here's how meditation and Buddhism will help you make more money and be a better worker and, like, you know, modify yourself to the horrible conditions of global capitalism. Right? Great. So, and then, of course, we might ask about neuromania. Like, oh, neuroscience and meditation. Wow. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting if you're interested in knowing how the brain works and what its capacities are and what it does. But it's sort of like just knowing that, you know, that lights up and that lights up and that lights up when you meditate. Like, would it have made any difference if it was like, you know, your pancreas lights up and your left toe? Without some kind of theoretical framework and some actually pretty laboriously one understanding of the brain and the organization of the brain and its connection with observable data and behavioral data and so on, it's really, really hard to get a picture of what any of that amounts to. So just the fact that, oh, neuroscience and meditation, it's like, that's, we shouldn't get all excited about that. Not that it's not interesting, it's just that, you know, it's like a, it's, you need to put some real, like, think about the brain and how it works for a long time even to get any kind of clue about what this bizarre thing does. It's like the thing that should not be. I mean, you've got this thing in your head that's like some kind of weird sea creature. And it's like, oh, whoa, look at that. Like, if you saw things that looked like brains or parts of brains, like the cerebellum or the basal ganglia, like swimming around in the ocean, you'd be like, oh, yeah, right. Weird creatures in the sea. Right? But no, that's in your head. Right? So the brain is kind of alien in a way, and it's hard to see in any direct way how it corresponds with your experience. So to learn these correspondences is really a serious undertaking. It should be done, but just saying, like, you know, doesn't solve the big problems. No, yet. So here are the papers I referred to, and then three films, The Dhamma Brothers. That's about the implementation of mindfulness meditation programs in the Alabama state prisons, which was shut down because it weren't Christian enough. And then, by the way, I'm from Texas, so I can use it. I grew up here, born and raised, born for work. So I can talk like that, all right? So, and then they shut it down. I think they restarted it. But it seemed to be, you know, actually offer a really good opiate of sorts to people who were locked up to help them out, like, and be beneficial to them. When the Iron Bird Flies is about how Tibetan Buddhism came to the United States. And there's a great story in there about a guy who was a student of Chogyam Trungpa, who was a drug smuggler, got caught, got put in prison for years, and about how meditation made his stay in prison like a paradise for him.
Defeated the purpose.
Yeah, he just gave me a retreat. Yeah. So, and then Free the Mind is about Richard Davidson, and it's about efforts to use meditation to treat PTSD with, you know, some success, but also some difficulties, and Crazy Wisdom, I mentioned that earlier. There's a bunch of books. Like, I can send these slides to anybody. We should talk a little bit, right? We have. Sorry, I took so long. I'm terrible. I've got 15 minutes. We can. You got to get them to a place where they stay open later. Or we should just tell them we're not leaving. What are they going to do?
Picking up on the assertion that whatever may insights or development benefits may come from meditation can really be found in other ways. Yeah. I'd like to use an analogy. Anyone that knows anything about psychotherapy has got to be aware that knowing something is very different than experiencing it. Mm-hmm. You could talk about the knowing it. Yeah. You can read about it in books till the sun sets. And that's very different than being able to embrace the experience of that. So I would want to argue that meditation, or in the sense that it is pursued within a Buddhist or Hindu or mystical tradition, focuses on, or it reaches for the direct experience of whatever it's after. Not through the mind or concepts or whatever. Not that those are not important, but just kind of understand that that's just, you know, that's just the iceberg of our consciousness. Yes. And that that this journey really can yield tremendous insight and tremendous transformation and tremendous compassion. And I would also add to that the argument that that yes, I think it does have an ethical dimension. Some of the great Buddhist stories are stories of Buddhas who would break out in a cold sweat when they realized there were some element of egoism, you know, in their enlightenment, and it'll reach a deeper state.
So, you can still hear me, right? So let me just say that I agree with you that meditation aims at giving you a kind of more experiential or direct, or something like a direct awareness of a lot of these things. So the things I said that you could maybe do, you know, it relate to meditation this way, these kind of things, they were all claims, kind of metaphysical claims, most of them. So the claim there was that, not that, you know, you would arrive at these as conclusions of arguments, where it was just sort of discursively represented, but that you can feel them in a more concrete way, right? And then about, let me just say about the ethics thing. What's really interesting is Madhyamaka Buddhism, if you know about Madhyamaka, that's really like a weird kind of, well, it's interpreted various ways. One way to interpret it is it's kind of Kantian, like the Kantian antinomies. It uses sort of arguments like the antinomies. Another way to think of it is it's kind of like deconstructing the basic categories of the mind. And you do this by a kind of conceptual focus, and it is a kind of like argumentation. So what you do, this is a Nagarjuna, who's the kind of father of this approach, you deconstruct the notions of substance, causation, time, space, all the things that are sort of central to the Kantian framework, basically, of course, many, many years to work on. And the end result of this is that you come to the experiential realization that ultimate reality is beyond all conception. That's kind of the idea. Like, you experience the noumenon, to put it in Kantian terms. And then about ethics, here's the problem with Madhyamaka that the Dalai Lama himself talks about. Well, according to Madhyamaka, pain is not ultimately real. There is really no such thing as suffering, strictly speaking. So you ask, oh, what does that do to Buddhist ethics? Because our imperative is to minimize suffering, right, and maximize well-being. Well, the Dalai Lama says, the conventional reality of suffering is enough. A bit in the way that Kant says, empirical realism is enough. That we don't need. So it's kind of like pain and suffering is transcendentally unreal, but empirically real, to speak Kantian. And that's enough, according to the Dalai Lama. But it does seem to be sort of a way in which you might undermine the ethical imperative, or at least make it problematic. But basically agree with what I'm saying.
It's kind of two related questions. Is meditation uniformly or consistently beneficial for all types of tasks, or would there be one meditation you'd use for one type of task and something else would be a different type of meditation? Well, for example, if you're doing something where all you have to do is focus, maybe it's analytical, would that be one type of meditation? Suppose you want to be creative, brainstorm, you know, come up with a new design for something where you're sort of wanting not to focus, but expand your horizons. You know, those is there an impact there where maybe meditation might not be beneficial for certain tasks, or maybe it's just the type of meditation?
Well, I think you certainly shouldn't do it when you're driving. I'm not actually joking. You shouldn't do it when you're driving. In fact, you can get this book by Matthew Ricard, where it comes with a CD, and it says, don't listen to this in the car. It's not good for driving. You're zoned out. We're crashing. More seriously, I think that, if you're doing one-pointed meditation, you're really training yourself to focus on one sort of thing. Now, the idea of this kind of task was that it generalizes, that in the sort of the history of Buddhism. So that once you're able to do this for a sustained period of time on anything, on your breath or on a candle, you can now do it to other stuff. And what they thought you should do is use it to think about Buddhist metaphysics and ethics. This was at least traditionally what they thought. So now you can sustain your focus on these issues for as long as you want. That was the idea. If you're looking for creativity, I don't know. I imagine something like, if it would be nice if you could, by meditative means, get yourself into a kind of a flow or fugue state or something, and just the ideas just go and you let them go. See what good stuff comes. Or take improvisation in music. People would get really good at that. If the definition of meditation I gave earlier is correct, that's really a form of meditation too, to be able to do that. So I don't know if the answer to your question is yes or no, but those are some ideas that are kind of in the ballpark. But don't do all your drugs.
Meditation at the end is to put something in our brain in which what we want to create in our lives.
Yeah, that's one technique, yeah.
The different points that you just said at the beginning, you know, like these people from South America dancing. Okay, you know, at the end...
Oh, they're not from South America. They're from, like, West Virginia.
Oh, okay. You know, I mean, at the end it's...
I'm not kidding.
What they put already on. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. It's what they put and what is their intention. So it doesn't matter if it's going to be through sex, tantra.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's going to be through singing or... at the end is to put something in our brain.
Yeah.
And our frontal lobe, which is at the end, you know, the brain is who starts creating. And after that, it starts working on it.
Yeah.
Now, tantra, exactly what is that for? Tantra is going to teach us to start moving the energy from chakras and fields to moving from the first to seven, and
right.
Then
release
once
the
we...
Release the kundalini.
Ah, exactly,
the
kundalini.
Power.
So once we have...
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, like, if for, let's see, I want... I want money. Simple.
You
want money.
Okay.
So what if I start having tantra? What I'm doing is moving the kundalini. I'm moving it. And in that moment...
Is that going to get you money?
We are going to send to our bands the information or our brain to start...
And it's like we're going to project... The money signal.
Yes.
Well,
that is the intention. That is, I mean, actually the intention.
Does it work very well?
Okay. When you don't have the money, it's because you don't believe you can have it.
Yeah.
Here, meditation is pretty much, I will say, for one reason. To start teaching your brain how to think.
Okay. Yeah. Can I respond to that? So look, it is true that the idea of Tantra, in both Hinduism and Buddhism, is to sort of, among other things, transform the way you see stuff. So one practice, which involves a lot of visualization, is to visualize the whole world and all the people in it as a great mandala, in which everybody around you is a Buddha. You are surrounded by Buddhas. And the idea is, if you can get yourself to see the world this way, you're going to treat people like they're Buddhas. You're not going to be offended by what they do. You're not going to, no matter what they do to you, you're going to be like, well, yeah, you're a Buddha. Okay, we're all good. So it's true that, and even with these practices that are sort of in the Vajrayana tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, considered lesser vehicles, like Hinayana and Mahayana, and Vajrayana is the diamond vehicle, the tantric vehicle. They think of these as sort of steps on the way, but they're not quite tantra, and they think that they are all designed to alter the way you react and see things, for sure. Here's something that I worry about with the mani signal stuff. It's a little bit like when I was a kid, I went to these churches where they would tell you, if you want to make money, you've got to give me money, right? And they put out the play, like Robert Telton, and the prosperity gospel, and it was like, oh yeah, so you find people who are struggling economically, write a check to Robert Telton, right? And other people like that, and hope that some, that puts a seed, plants some metaphysical seed that's going to grow into the money tree, right? And that has always seemed to me to be perfectly described by Karl Marx. Here's something true that Marx said. He said a lot of false things, but he said a lot of true things. One of the true things is that ideology can be used to make people do stuff that's contrary to their own economic interests, so to continue their oppression. That's, to me, that's what seems like going on with that. It's like somebody says, hey, look, I got rich. You can get rich too. I'll tell you the secret if you give me money. What is the secret? It's put your faith out there, shoot your signal out or whatever, and the money will come back. And that's going to involve a $49.95, a month payment to me, right? It's like, I know your secret. You just convinced a bunch of gullible people to give you money. That's your secret, right? So this is the kind of thing that makes me sympathetic with Karl Marx. I'm not naturally sympathetic with Karl Marx, but that kind of thing does. So I would like be afraid that you're getting fleeced. And I think that any person who is a serious practitioner of Buddha, I don't know, but because after all, there are a lot of stories about how monasteries in Tibet and elsewhere used plenty of techniques to keep the money rolling in, right? So we can't just say, oh, they are the pure ones. But, at least in principle, it's not supposed to be about money. I'm going to say the same about Christianity, too. This is why I always thought the prosperity, if Jesus were around, remember what he did in the temple to the money changers?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Jesus were around, he'd be like, prosperity, doctrine people, get out of here. You turn the house of God into a den of thieves. Sorry.
Yeah.
You're bringing out the preachers.
Last question here. I'm afraid we're running out of time.
Ken, Drs. Newberg and Doc Willie wrote that book.
Spiritual.
Why God Won't Go Away, and they did scientific studies. It kind of confused me when you said all these other things were meditations, or whether you're a splitter or a lumper or strict or loose constructionist, but in my mind, or from what I've studied or understand, meditation is focusing, is mindfulness of what you're focusing on.
Yeah, that's one thing.
Clearing your mind, but you don't have to just sit and you can be meditating or mindful walking.
That's true.
Or
yeah.
Eating or
that's
but it's a kind of a focusing, it's a mindfulness of of your internal or external, whatever you're doing. Is that right?
I would say that's a version of mindfulness meditation. But there are other techniques. So with mindfulness, you're certainly not focusing on one thing and bringing your focus back on it, like in one pointed, right? So what you described is a form of mindfulness meditation that you can actually practice, maybe even while driving, maybe. One pointed, I'd be a little more careful with the driving. But mindfulness you can maybe do while you drive. But walking meditation, too, is kind of goes well with mindfulness meditation. Yeah. But I'm careful to say, I want to say it's not just one thing. There are many things called meditation, even if we restrict ourselves to meditative traditions, right? There are many different activities that are called meditation, bhavana, cultivation or development. So. Yes, sir. Well, last.